9 FM HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, April Fool's Day 2012, here at AM 580 WILL. It's going to be a great show today. We've got a book and an author I've been wanting to have for a couple of years now. We're fortunate enough to have her. There are a few issues that's important to the future of this country, the present and future, as the education system, the public education system. Our guest today is going to talk about the great battles going on over public education, where it's going, and what the terms are of the debate. An authoritative figure, Diane Ravitch, will be joining us for the full hour. I hope you'll join us. Before we go to our guest, though, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey. The digital divide in the U.S. is creating a massive chasm between the broadband haves and have-nots. A recent study shows a widening gap between internet adopters across the nation. Although broadband subscribership increased in many states from 2008 to 2010, the study found that 40% of households nationwide do not have a broadband connection. The states that are least connected also tend to be the poorest. John Dunbar is managing editor at the Center for Public Integrity and co-wrote the study with the investigative reporting workshop.
I think the most striking thing of all, though, was that this income divide has become even more clear, particularly in the South.
Mississippi had the lowest subscriber rate at 35%, along with a $36,850 median income. Other low subscribing states include Alabama, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Tennessee, and West Virginia. Wealthier states where median incomes are over $60,000 ranked near the top.
We really are separating into two worlds when it comes to broadband, which is the super users, people who really spend more than $100 plus on their wireless devices so they can download high-definition movies, versus this kind of broadband underclass, which may have access to it, but culturally may not understand the importance of it and just doesn't have the disposable income to spend to use it. That's a much nastier problem than straight access.
Dunbar said broadband has become more and more of a necessity as people increasingly rely on the internet to apply to college, look for jobs, and do their work. He says the lack of broadband entrenches poverty.
So people who do have good access, good connections, and good speed will continue to do better in society, and people who do not will just be left further and further behind.
Dunbar says the problem isn't access to broadband, but something that's more difficult to fix, convincing non-adopters that broadband is essential and then actually making it affordable.
I think that those actually are solvable problems. You know, the challenge is coming up with a coherent policy and strategy for attacking those problems and really recognizing that that is the primary problem. I hope, you know, this report will at least get people to start to pay attention to, you know, this fact of it's not about access, dummy, it's about adoption.
To read the report, visit iWatchNews.org.
The city of Albuquerque pulled the plug on longtime public access channel operator, quote unquote, with little regard for city protocol, and many in the community are crying foul. Quote unquote's contract was not up for renewal, but according to a city ordinance, the operator must undergo periodic reviews to iron out any problems that the Cable Franchise and Hearing Board identifies. Mayor Richard Berry circumvented the board and appointed an ad hoc committee to review quote unquote's performance. Quote unquote's executive director, Steve Ranieri, was unaware of any problems.
Well, they never discussed with us anything that wasn't working right or nothing. We asked for meetings, they wouldn't give them to us.
The committee, which put the contract out to bid, criticized, quote unquote, for being too involved in the community and loading its submission for bid with too much information. Yes, you heard that correctly. The committee chose a curious replacement. A company unknown in the community with no experience in actual television broadcasting that was, wait for it, the highest bidder. The company, UPublic, had been awarded Albuquerque's educational access channel over a year ago, but has yet to produce a single program for it. In fact, there's no mention of the educational channel on UPublic's website. In contrast, Quote Unquote's website includes its programming schedule, training schedules, and other information for the public. In an attempt to make sense of the decision, Ranieri requested public records about public access and got over 1,500 pages of documents.
Amongst those records are a number of emails back and forth between the SHU public group and people at the city who are driving this whole thing. And you can see that they were just pretty much had thought about this and made up the decision to do this back as far as the fall of 2010.
So what's really going on here? One reason for the switch to UPublic has to do with content.
They do want to control speech in this town. They object to some of the programming. They object to the opinions of the people in the community. They object to the fact that we put Democracy Now! On every day at 9 a.m.
Meanwhile, support for Quote Unquote is building. The cable board asserted its authority and recommended it be awarded the contract for the public access channel. The community has responded with letters, calls, and visits to city officials in support of Quote Unquote. The city council is scheduled to vote on who will get the contract April 2nd. Stay tuned. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 on April 1st, 2012. Our guest today joining us on the phone is Professor Diane Ravitch, who's the research professor of education at New York University, the author of numerous books, considered one of the great historians of American education of the past generation. And we're here to talk primarily about her most recent book, the bestseller, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education, published by Basic Books in 2010 and released again more recently with a paper epilogue updated and expanded. Professor Ravitch, thank you very much for joining us today on Media Matters.
Hi, Bob. Please call me Diane. Nice to be with you.
Well, I will, Diane. Well, it's great to have you. And I must tell you, I read the book, obviously, for the show, and I was surprised for a book that the initial length, I'm saying, well, this is going to take a while. I absolutely sailed through this book. I mean, it was extraordinarily well written.
Well, thank you. I've been writing a long time, and I've always had in mind trying not to write for education professors, but trying to write for people who read daily newspapers, and to communicate some really, really important issues in everyday language, not in education jargon.
Well, this is one case where we can say mission accomplished and be accurate. Let's start, if we can, Professor Diane. Something that's not in the book, but I've always wondered about, and I think you're the ideal person to ask. When did the idea of public education being a right for all Americans through, say, 12th grade, K through 12, when did that become sort of universally acknowledged as the way things should be in the U.S.? Because, I mean, it's not in the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence, per se. I assume there was a historical process where we got to that point. Can you just briefly tell us what that was?
Well, the word education does not appear in the Constitution. And yet, at the same time, the founders, the people who wrote the Constitution, passed the Northwest Land Ordinance that called on all of the new territories, you know, the Midwest and all the new states, to set aside land for public schools. So it's not considered a constitutional right. It's become one, in effect, and I guess you'd say just as a matter of necessity. The Brown decision said that without education, children were likely to be affected for the rest of their lives. We know this to be true. I would say that because I'm a historian, we didn't consider education through grade 12 to be either a necessity or a right, certainly until the last few decades. It's still not, as I said, it's still not a constitutional right. Some people think that it should be. But we still have today about maybe 80% of our students graduating high school. So it's not even a reality at this point. And yet everyone recognizes that if you don't at least finish high school, you're going to be severely handicapped for the rest of your life.
One of the things that you bring out in the book that I didn't know, because you're talking about the current crisis of K through 12 education, of public education, and all the political fights going about over it in the book, and that's what we're going to talk about in the show. But you make a couple of points that I wasn't aware of. First of all, this notion of public education being in crisis, this seems to be a recurring theme throughout the history of education.
Well, absolutely. I could go back, and I haven't gone back in other books, to the early 20th century. And that's when we first began saying education is in crisis. In the 19-teens, it was in crisis because the schools were being overwhelmed by immigrant children, and all the business interests were saying, we need vocational education. These kids are not going to go to college. They need to learn how to work in a job. And then there was another crisis in the 20s because there wasn't enough seats for everybody who was supposed to be in school. And then every decade there's been a crisis. This crisis is different, though. I mean, this is the first time in the history of public education in the United States where the crisis is being pitched as the problem is public education. The problem, and this is the way you hear it from the critics, the people who are calling themselves reformers, the problem is that public education needs to be turned over to private interest. So this is very different because before, for all the years, let's say, of the 20th century, every time there was a crisis, the critics would say, we need more funding, we need to get rid of segregation, we need better prepared teachers, we need a stronger curriculum. All of these were meant to improve public education. But now, for instance, with the recent report from the Condoleezza Rice Joel Klein Commission, Council on Foreign Relations, they said public education is the problem. Public education is a national security risk, and they advocate more choice, meaning, more charters, more vouchers, and so forth.
One of the points you also make in the book that I was unaware of, although I should have known because I went to public schools in the 1960s, and I thought I went to excellent schools. I didn't get the sense that they were dramatically better than the schools two or three decades later. And you make the point that a lot of the critique today of how bad public education is and what a problem it is are premised on the idea that it was a lot better 30, 40, 50 years ago. But in fact, that wasn't the case, was it?
Well, you know, there's always been the sense that once there was a golden age and now there is no golden age anymore. And people have always been looking back to their own childhood and saying it was ideal then and look what a mess the younger generation is. That's certainly true in education today. But I think that what's also true is and people have been saying this for 30 years, there's a breakdown of the family, there's less discipline, and there are certainly schools where teachers are struggling to maintain order, and where teachers are overwhelmed by having large numbers of children who don't speak English, and also the mainstreaming of children with special needs. This is different. I mean, 50 years ago, there were segregated schools in many parts, racially segregated schools in many parts of the country. Children with disabilities didn't have any right to a free public education, and there was not the kind of high level of immigration that we've had in recent decades. So to people who were educated as I was and as you were 40 and 50 years ago, those schools may seem idyllic, but that was then and this is now. We have to deal with the problems we have and the issues that we have.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Professor Diane Ravitch from New York University, author of numerous books in the history of American education. Her most recent is the national bestseller, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education, published by Basic Books. The phone lines are open at Media Matters if you want to join us here at WILL. 217-333-9455 is our local line. Toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Again, our guest, Diane Ravitch, the education historian. Diane, in the book, one of the interesting parts of the book, and I think one of the reasons the book got so much attention, is that to some extent what this book is you are rejecting a position you held and advocated to a certain extent in the 1990s and into the zeros, and really going through a lot of evidence and saying what I believe doesn't add up or what I was advocating before doesn't really add up with the evidence. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, that is a fair assessment. I after I served as Assistant Secretary for Research in the first Bush administration in the early 1990s, I then worked in three different conservative think tanks. And the kinds of ideas that have now become part of the mainstream were being hatched at that point in conservative think tanks, and that was the charter movement. It wasn't even a movement then. It was an idea that, well, we can't get vouchers past any state referendum. Vouchers are going nowhere, but charters will accomplish the same goal, which is to move public money into private hands. And there was a tremendous emphasis within the conservative think tanks about testing and accountability. It's now become such a commonplace that it is, in fact, bipartisan. But what I realized, having been part of this for years, was it wasn't working. The testing and accountability were leading to really bad results for the kids and for teachers. It was narrowing the curriculum. I've observed district after district eliminating the arts, cutting back on physical education, on the teaching of history and foreign languages, because days and days of the school year are now devoted to test prep. And the testing companies they're making lots more money with selling test prep materials, but it's not producing a better quality of education. If anything, I think it's really harmful to education that if you think about children spending years and years just learning how to answer multiple choice questions, that doesn't prepare them for anything very important in society. But that's become the norm in our schools, and I think it's very harmful. It also plays into this narrative of our schools are failing, 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 because no one can meet the impossible goals of No Child Left Behind. I mean, I devoted a chapter to No Child Left Behind and how the whole theory was there had been a miracle in Texas. This was George W. Bush's story when he ran for president in 2000. But it's 10 years later. We know there was no miracle in Texas, and there's not been any miracle in the United States as a result of all of this incessant testing. So, the book is, for me, it is saying, hey, guys, we're heading in the wrong direction, and I made a mistake, and I want to, I was wrong, and we should really find some fresh thinking here. I mean, the accountability movement is now 20 years old, and yet the political people are just doubling down on more and more of the same approaches.
You've mentioned both vouchers and voucher schools and charter schools, and can you explain the difference for someone who's not really on the inside of the debate?
Sure. Well, vouchers have been rejected again and again. The idea is that if you give the public money to parents, in effect, you give them a voucher, they can take it to any school. It can be a religious school. It can be any kind of school that they want to go to, an online charter school. But it's basically a way of getting around the legal requirement in most states that you can't use public money to go to religious schools. And that's been having a resurgence. Indiana passed the statewide voucher plan. Vouchers have been in place now in Milwaukee and Cleveland and Washington, D.C. for a number of years. And now there are some other states, particularly where they're very, very conservative governors, like Louisiana, that are where the voucher legislation is being advanced. Again, that's giving the money to parents or a voucher to parents to go to basically a non-public school. A charter school, this was the idea to take the place of vouchers on the part of conservatives. A charter school is basically handing the public money over to a private corporation or a private board of trustees, and they can enlist children with public money and create a school that's privately managed and private in every sense of the word except that the money comes from the state. People who run charter schools say they're public schools, but I've come to think they're actually not public schools. They're really semi-private or almost completely private because they're deregulated and the public has very little say about what happens in them other than to say you meet your test score goals or you might be closed down. That's basically the difference between a charter school and a voucher school.
Now, Professor Ravitch, when I heard about vouchers initially decades ago, it automatically sort of sent a red flag up in my brain because it said, if you can have schools, if your best students who private schools will want to admit can all leave the public system, and the public system then becomes much less desirable for those who remain, and everyone's going to want to sort of jump a sinking ship. In the end, it seems logical, especially in a country with a great deal of poverty, you're relegating a significant part of the population to having no viable education at all.
Well, this is the great danger, and this is why, partly why I wrote my book, because I could see that what was moving forward, particularly with charters, which is much more momentum behind it than vouchers does at this point, but charters and vouchers together, along with the push to have online charter schools where kids don't even go to a building, they sit home in front of a computer, all of this will end up decimating public education in America. And what I think the public needs to know, what your listeners need to know, is that when we compare ourselves to the highest performing nations in the world, whether it's Finland or Korea or Japan or the Singapore city state, all of them have a strong public education system. They don't have vouchers and charters, and they don't use testing in the very punitive way that we do. So what we're doing under the banner of reform is doing things that are actually undermining the quality of education and hurting and harming public education. And no other country is doing this, at least no high-performing country is doing this.
And again, this is something I've thought for a long time, and your book didn't dissuade me. And as I ask you the question I'm about to ask you, Diane Ravitch, I want to make clear that I understand that many of the people who are proponents of charter schools and maybe even vouchers and testing, all this, genuinely believe this is the best thing for children. I understand. So I don't want to cast aspersion on the motives of everyone I'm about to cast aspersion on. But at the same time, I look at the state of Wisconsin and some other states where I have firsthand experience, and it seems like a lot of the people who are just obsessed with getting rid of public education are kids or parents or grown-ups who have kids in private schools or have never had any interest in public schools to speak of. And in every other issue, have shown no particular interest in the welfare or well-being of poor people and working-class people. And suddenly we're supposed to believe they have this overriding interest in their education.
Well, yes, I think I don't mean to cast aspersion either, but it's become clear to me that the charter movement, in many cases, not in every case, and I've met people running charter schools who are really trying to help the kids who are neediest, but I don't think that's the mainstream anymore. When I supported the charter movement 20 years ago, I thought that charters would actually be laboratories of innovation, and a few are. I thought they would actually reach out to kids who are dropouts, and a few do. But most of the charters today come in making a false claim. Most of them are saying, we can get higher scores in public schools, therefore we're better than the regular public schools. But the way many of them are getting higher scores is by picking their students, not taking the same proportion of kids with special needs, not taking the same proportion of English language learners. And there have been many state studies and district studies showing that the charters are basically skimming. And you can always get higher test scores if you're not taking the low-scoring students. But then if you stop and think, well, what does that do to the local public schools? It means that they have disproportionately large numbers of the kids who are most expensive to educate. And there's also something that in the social science literature is known as peer effects, and that is that if you only go to school with other kids who are motivated, you'll do better. But that's the end of our public education system, if that's the goal, which is to sort out the wheat and the chaff and just have the highest-performing kids leaving the public system and the lowest-performing kids left in public schools. The irony of all of this is that despite the claims made by charter advocates, charters actually don't get better results than regular public schools when you're looking at the same kids, despite the advantages that they have of being able to remove kids, of having very, very strict discipline policies, almost like a boot camp in some charter schools. They don't get better results.
Yeah, that was one of the most striking things in your book when I was reading it. And your book is filled with the latest data, hard evidence on the claims, which is, so instead of just being a polemic, your book is, I think, a very reasoned and evidence-rich argument that you're making. One of the arguments you make that I think is very important, and I think I'd like you to take a moment to talk about, if you would, Professor Ravitch, is the idea that you can apply the values that make a successful business and plunk those down on an education system. Even you don't even need to know that much about education per se, but any institution, if you apply the same values that made Microsoft or General Motors or Walmart successful into an education, you can produce a high quality of education, get more bang for your buck. And that seems to be a lot of the underlying sort of thinking behind this entire privatization movement. And what's your take on that?
Well, I think you're right. This is a lot of the rhetoric talks about business values. The talk is about having consumer choice and competition, and somehow if schools compete, then everyone wins. We could look at Milwaukee as an example of why that's not true. Milwaukee has had vouchers now for 21 years. Kids can take their public money and go to a religious school or other kinds of schools other than the public schools charter. Milwaukee has also had charter schools, so we have competition there. But the beneficiaries of all of this choice were supposed to be African-American children in Milwaukee, and they're actually doing very poorly. The kids in the voucher schools don't do any better than the kids in the regular public schools, and same for the kids in the charter schools. And there is such a thing as the federal testing program. Milwaukee last year for the first time participated in the federal testing program. And it turns out that after 21 years of all this choice and competition, Milwaukee is one of the lowest scoring districts in the United States. It's probably somewhere slightly better than Detroit, but not much better. So that choice and competition did nothing, because people who work in schools, teachers and principals, understand they're not competing with the school down the road. They're not competing with the school across town. When a school works, it's because the people in the school are working together. It's like people on a rowboat. Each one has an oar, and they're all rowing together in order to make the boat move forward. I mean, there is tremendous collaboration and teamwork needed to make a school function. And when a school is really, really a good school, it's because there's a sense of a culture of people caring about each other, working together, sharing what they know. This is why merit pay, for example, has never worked anywhere, and it's been tried now for almost 100 years, because teachers don't want to compete with the teacher in the next classroom. They want to work together. They're usually teaching the same children. So that's what makes a school work, is not competition with the school across town. That may work for the football team, but it doesn't work for education.
Well, if I can also add, Professor Diane Ravitch, the people who run the country, who are at the top, the commanding figures in business and commerce and government, they don't send their own kids to commercial schools, for-profit schools. They send them to private schools that are nonprofit, non-commercial, have small classrooms and collegiality among the faculty. For their own kids, they understand this is what a great education is. There's no evidence, is there, that sort of commercial values are really a very effective way to do education.
Well, there's no evidence for it at all. In fact, if you look at the for-profit corporations, most of them do very badly in education. Most of them have a very high dropout rate. The greatest example of that would be the for-profit online industry, which every time I turn on my computer, I see an ad for an online for-profit company, and the name of their game is just having lots of students enroll, and they collect the tuition, and the dropout rate every year is 50%, because the kids, at a certain point, they just can't maintain the motivation. Interacting with a computer is not nearly as good as interacting with a human being who's going to look in your eye and either give you a compliment or urge you to do better. But you're quite right that if you look at the leading business figures in this country, the ones who, in many cases, are urging privatization of public education, where do they send their own kids? I mean, their own kids are in schools where the class size is 12 to 15, where they have beautiful campuses and where they have wonderful resources and where they have the arts and all the things that are being cut out in public education. And I think we should follow their lead.
Our guest today, Professor Diane Ravitch from New York University, the author of numerous books on the history of American education. Her most recent book, the one we've been talking about, is The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education, the revised and expanded paper edition just released by Basic Books. Terrific book. If people would like to call in with questions or comments for Professor Ravitch, the number here at Media Matters is 217-333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Professor Ravitch, the subtitle of the book deals with testing. You've already talked about testing a couple of times in the program. It is the centerpiece of the No Child Left Behind law that was passed just about 10 years ago, exactly by President George W. Bush, his administration in Congress. And, for people who haven't been in school for a while, so or maybe don't even have school-age kids anymore, or never did. What is this whole testing thing about? What does that mean when you talk about testing?
Well, back when you and I were in school, we were not judged all the time by standardized tests on reading and math. But all that changed 10 years ago when President George W. Bush signed this legislation into law. It was in January of 2002. And the law, which is, 1,000 pages long, basically what it says is that every public school in the United States must achieve 100% proficiency for all of its students in grades 3 through 8 by the year 2014. 2 years from now, 100% of students are supposed to be proficient in reading and math. And so the schools across the country were required to administer tests in reading and math regularly, yearly, and then to report whether they're on track to be 100% proficient. Now, you have to understand that there's no nation in the world that has ever achieved 100% proficiency. So Congress set an impossible goal, and schools all over the country are failing to meet it. We now have more than half the schools in the country have been designated as failing schools, and that number is going to continue to rise because the Democrats and Republicans have not been able to get together and decide how to change this very odious law. Everybody agrees it's not functioning. And yet they just can't, they're sort of locked into this idea that we can't stop testing. We have to test everybody every year. And it has created a regime in the schools where literally billions of dollars are now being spent on testing at the same time that teachers are being laid off. And, you know, like the state of Texas over the past 4 years cut $13 billion out of public education, but that didn't stop them from awarding a $500 million testing contract. So everybody's wedded to the standardized test, even though it's not producing better education. We can see this from 10 years of No Child Left Behind. And it's also created this national narrative of, oh, gosh, our schools can't meet the target of 100% proficiency, they're failing schools. So we're in the process of demonizing one of our basic democratic institutions, and it's insane. And the Obama administration's race to the top is, in effect, double down on that strategy because it's saying, well, you know, we're going to give you more money if you agree to open more privately managed schools, more charter schools, if you agree to evaluate your teachers based on the test scores of their students. And, you know, the great irony of Race to the Top is that it requires more teaching to the test because it incentivizes merit pay, which means teaching to the test, and evaluating teachers by test scores, which means teaching to the test. So we're trapped in this terrible approach to education, which is not improving education and which is leading to massive demoralization of teachers. There have been two major surveys that came out just in the past few weeks showing that the morale of teachers is down across the country.
You know, I have several friends who've been career teachers for decades in a couple of cases, and they all say is the most striking feature of the change in their profession right now. Two of them have taken early retirement, in fact, just sort of out of complete demoralization. These are people who are absolutely the sort of people you write about in your book, who are dedicated teachers who just did it with a passion throughout their career, and just find the whole testing culture and the sort of management culture not antithetical to what they wanted to do when they got into the profession.
Well, that's exactly right, because what I've found, and I've traveled the country over the past 2 years, is teachers saying, you know, I love my kids, I love the work I do, I can't stand what they're doing to me. They're taking away my autonomy, they're taking away my ability to make any decisions, and I will be judged by the scores of my students, and this is so crazy. I don't know if you saw this in the news, but a few weeks ago, New York City released the ratings of something like 18,000 teachers. And it became almost a subject of hilarity in New York because so many of the ratings were so absurd. Really excellent teachers got low ratings, and the ratings were completely arbitrary.
Well, you know, as a teacher myself at the college level, but been doing it for quite some time, you understand that rating systems of any kind really can never capture the essence of the teaching experience, and oftentimes can be way, way off. And you had a chapter in your book I was moved by about, I guess, the person you would consider the best teacher you had, mm-hmm. Ruby Ratliff, who was your English teacher, I think, in high school. And I think I had a teacher like that. I bet most listeners did. And your argument, if I got it right, was this is a teacher, the way she operated with her tremendous passion for teaching and her commitment to excellence, you know, she wouldn't fit into the current sort of cookie cutter mold they want in the No Child Left Behind era of teaching vocabulary tests.
Well, she would have been very unhappy had her worth as a teacher been judged by the test scores of her students, because the test, if you understood, if you saw these standardized tests, you would think, you know, this is a ridiculous way to judge teachers. They're very narrow. They only deal with math and reading. And so in many schools, well, I'd say in every school today, most teachers are not teachers of math and reading. And so the schools are now scrambling to create new tests so that they can test everything. There will be schools testing the arts and dance and physical education and social studies and science.
Well, there won't be any time to teach if you're taking all these tests.
Well, that's exactly right. There are some school districts that report that they're spending weeks on test prep. And this is just not professional. It's bad education. None of the countries that we look to as being great school systems are doing this. I mean, I was in Finland last fall, and in Finland, kids don't even take standardized tests, and yet this is one of the top-performing systems in the world.
And it's a system, I read your article or your blog piece on Finland, where the teachers are relatively well paid. It's completely unionized teaching force. So the teachers unions that are in this country are regarded as, you know, one notch above pedophiles, sort of in the public meter. They play a central role in the best school system in the world.
Yeah, in Finland, the teachers and the principals all belong to the same union, and they negotiate for better working conditions. The Finnish teachers are paid about the same as our teachers. I mean, teachers don't make a fortune. This is not a highly paid profession. But I think what's going on in this country is to actually remove all the vestiges of professionalism. In Louisiana, for example, right now they're in the process of passing Governor Bobby Jindal's legislation, which will make, if a teacher is rated ineffective 1 year, they can be fired right on the spot. Now, a lot of people right now are complaining teachers shouldn't have tenure. Well, if teachers don't have tenure, who's going to be able to teach about global warming or teach about evolution or teach about any controversial issues, because they can be fired on the spot if they displease some group in the community? There's a reason for tenure.
And tenure doesn't guarantee permanent employment, as you point out in the book, for a it's not the same as a college professor's tenure.
No, and that's something that I think is so important to say again and again. In K-12 education, tenure does not mean lifetime guarantee of a job. I know that the governor of Connecticut recently said if you get tenured for breathing or showing up or something like that, that's not true. First of all, someone has to agree that you get tenure, and tenure doesn't mean lifetime job. What it means is you have a right to a hearing if someone wants to fire you. I think that's a very American idea, that you have a trial of 3 or 4 years, and your principal says, you know, you're good, you're entitled to due process rights, and if I or someone else decides to fire you, you have the right to have evidence presented. Now, this should not be a process that lasts for years, but certainly people who've been judged worthy of due process, that's not an un-American idea. I think that's a very solid idea.
You know, Professor Diane Ravitch, I have a confession. I could talk to you for 24 hours and never share the microphone, but that would be unfair to my listeners. I have a full bank of callers who've been waiting patiently to ask you questions. I've got to turn the show over to them now. Let's now go to line one, Champagne. You're on the air with Professor Diane Ravitch.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity here. Dr. Ravitch, years ago I heard that there was work at the University of Chicago dealing with the two sigma difference, and that referred to the idea that tutorials were significantly better than other approaches to teaching. Is there current evidence or current research that is dealing with the efficacy of tutorials, and is there anywhere in public education that tutorials are being used?
You know, I think you would find tutorials if you looked at places like Exeter or Andover or these very elite private schools. But right now, the public schools of this country are under such budgetary stress that they're bursting at the seams.
Diane, sure. By tutorials, you mean one-on-one teaching. Is that correct?
Yes, he means like 12 students sitting around talking with the teacher.
Okay, because sometimes tutorial means just one-on-one, like at Oxford or something.
Well, certainly one-on-one teaching is wonderful. I mean, that's but it's just totally unaffordable.
Yeah, exactly.
At this point, 12-1 is unaffordable.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to our next caller now. Again, Champagne on line two. You're on the air with Professor Ravitch.
Thank you. Professor Ravitch, I wonder if you could talk some about the effect of the Brown versus Board of Topeka decision on our current status of education, particularly as it relates to vouchers and charter schools. Because if I remember correctly, as soon as that decision was passed, some of the southern schools closed their public schools because they wanted to avoid the whole idea of desegregation. So I'll hang up and listen to your conversation. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And I might add, Professor Ravitch does discuss this in her book.
Thank you. This is actually a great question. I should mention I was at Illinois State last week, so I'm glad to hear all these callers from Illinois. It's a great question because the idea of choice is very much rooted in the Brown decision. As soon as the Brown decision came out in 1954, southern states and southern communities wanted, of course, not to desegregate, and so they thought of this legal strategy of creating choice schools and saying that any student could go to whatever school they wanted to, knowing that that would keep the status quo intact and that black students would stay in black schools and white students would stay in white schools. There is now, I think, compelling evidence from the Civil Rights Project at UCLA that charter schools are, in fact, more segregated than the districts that they're in. And this is true even in districts that have very little integration. At least there's some integration, whereas in the charter schools, increasingly we see that they are even blacker or more Hispanic than the district that they're in. And there was a great article by John Hechinger in Bloomberg News about Minnesota, saying that there were charters there that were all white, all black, all Hispanic, and they were designed as such. So, in effect, what we're seeing is a kind of it's an idea that's called reform, but it ends up repealing the promise of the Brown decision.
Our guest again, Professor Diane Ravitch. You're just listening to author of the book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education, the revised and expanded paperback edition just released by Basic Books. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 3, Tinley Park, you're on the air with Professor Ravitch.
Hello, Professor. Interesting discussion. I've got a question about the Common Core standards that are slated to be fully implemented in school districts by the year 2014. What is your opinion of the Common Core standards in general, and could you forecast whether you think that the majority of those states are going to be able to fully implement that, have those specific resources in place to do that, and so on?
Well, here's my
just, if I could, Diane, before you get into that, just give a little background on what those
are. Sure.
Yeah.
Well, a few years ago, the National Governors Association and the Chief State School Officers, the State Commissioners of Education, decided to embark on a project to develop national standards. And so they created what they call the Common Core standards in English and in math. So there are two sets of standards. And then the Obama administration has this $5 billion competition for the states where they said if you want to be eligible to get some of this $5 billion, it would be wise for you to adopt these Common Core standards. So something like 45 states have now said they will adopt the Common Core standards in English and math, and that's considered a great triumph for national standards. The problem with it is, and this has bothered me because I have over the years worked in different states developing state standards, is that standards are only words on paper until they're implemented somewhere. Once they're implemented, you've got to have a mechanism in place to change them because teachers will tell you what works and what doesn't work. Words on paper don't do anything. You have to hear from the teachers what belongs in fifth grade, what belongs in sixth grade, where you have too much coverage that no one can do it, where it's too hard for that grade. I mean, there are all these problems that haven't been ironed out because oddly enough, or ironically enough, these Common Core standards were all, with all the millions and millions behind them that the Gates Foundation and other foundations have put in, they've never been implemented or field tested anywhere. And I think that it's really important, and I've urged this on the administration almost 2 years ago, do a field test. Let someone try them out and find out what works and what doesn't work. But they've never done that field test. So we're going to be putting them into place in 45 states simultaneously. And I don't know if there's going to be any process for fixing what's wrong with them because no standards are ever perfect just because they got written down. I would say that there are two other problems. One is that with all the budget cuts, there's not going to be much money for implementation. There's not going to be much money for professional development. If teachers don't know how to teach these standards, I don't know how they're going to be implemented. The other is that I think there's a real concern, or should be a real concern, that if they are truly rigorous, and some people think they are truly rigorous, we might see an expansion of the achievement gap between children who are rich and poor and between children of different races, because the children who can't read well might fall farther behind if these standards are truly rigorous. So these are problems that ought to be fixed before they're implemented, and we'll see what happens. Nobody knows right now whether they're good or not because they've never been tried.
This is a point you make, Diane, in your book and in your writings about that you just touched on, which is the, you know, we have a situation now in the United States where we're approaching the point where one in four children will be living formerly in poverty. Over half our children are now in low-income families, which is pretty poor by the standards I'm accustomed to. And most Americans, I think, you know, would find that pretty poor. And this is quite different from a country like Finland. And it puts a tremendous burden on schools that really schools aren't equipped to address.
Yeah, this is actually probably what I'd consider the biggest problem in education as well as in our society, is that we're not even facing up to the disadvantages of kids who come from poverty. Because the achievement gap is blamed on the schools, but the achievement gap begins before the first day of school. When children arrive in school, there's already a huge difference based on the fact that kids who come from affluent middle-class homes have health care, they live in stable homes, they don't move frequently, their parents don't have to worry about paying the rent or paying their mortgage. And there are just huge disadvantages associated with living in poverty. And we actually lead the advanced nations of the world in having the highest percentage of children living in poverty. That gets reflected in the schools. The schools can't create jobs. The schools can't cure homelessness. All of these social issues ought to be addressed by our policymakers, but instead they just keep hammering the schools and blaming the schools for low performance, which is really, really tightly correlated to income, to poverty. Every testing program that's administered, whether it's in this country or internationally, shows that kids from affluence do well and kids from poverty do poorly. And that's true on the ACT, the SAT, the national scores, and every state scores. You know, you could look at any testing program and you'll find that to be true.
Let's go back to the phone lines now to our next caller. Now we're going to our toll-free line, line 4, Tacoma, Washington. You're on the air with Diane Ravitch.
Hello, Professor. I am increasingly concerned about all the private foundation money that is coming into the area of educational research that's shaping what is, the direction of the schools. And I'm thinking of the Gates Foundation and the Broad and Walden folks. And not as if it's not that they're bad researchers. These are very professional, quality researchers. But what they choose to these foundations, what they choose to fund, are definitely a agenda, and that agenda is shaping with their money the educational direction, that choice and teacher quality and test scores, evaluating the teachers and so forth. Can you speak to that, please?
Sure. There's a chapter in my book, Chapter 10, called The Billionaire Boys Club, and it's basically about three big foundations: the Gates Foundation, the Broad Foundation of Los Angeles, and the Walton Family Foundation of Arkansas, which is the Walmart fortune. Now, all of these three foundations are funding basically two things. They're funding, in the case of the Gates Foundation, they used to be into small high schools, and they gave that up after spending $2 billion. But they're now into teacher evaluation as their overwhelming concern, but they're also funding a lot of charter schools. The Walton Family Foundation is overwhelmingly devoted to choice, to privatization, to vouchers, to charters. They just put out $159 million in one fell swoop to education groups that would promote that agenda. The Gates Foundation is spending close to $100 million a year for advocacy groups to support its agenda. The Broad Foundation trains superintendents, many of them who have no education background, to go out and bring a business approach to running public schools. So all of these foundations, including the Dell Foundation and a bunch of others, are heavily funding charter schools, choice, this narrative that somehow the country is overwhelmed with bad teachers and we have to find the perfect evaluation system in order to find and fire those bad teachers. What all of this avoids talking about is the necessity of doing something about poverty. I mean, our schools are being overwhelmed by budget cuts and, English language learners, kids who don't speak or read English, and children with disabilities, and all of these issues are overwhelming the schools, and yet these foundations would have us believe that the answer is finding the perfect teacher evaluation system, taking teachers' tenure rights away, reducing teachers' pensions, doing all kinds of things to demoralize teachers, and then creating charter schools and vouchers. And it's like the real problems don't exist on the same universe with the agenda of these various huge foundations. And by the way, I should add that there are almost no foundations where grassroots groups can go and say, I want to fight to protect public education in my community. Who's supporting that? And I have a hard time thinking of any.
In the book, you have long, detailed chapters on the various reform efforts in places like San Diego and New York City, Washington, D.C., and you talk about Michelle Rhee, who was the head of the school system in Washington, D.C. for a while. And I remember when she took over the job, she got an absolutely glowing article on her, I believe, in the New York Sunday Times magazine. And I had a friend of mine call me up who's a very smart guy, and he goes, boy, she's fantastic. She's going to be exactly what's going to solve all the problems. And you write in the book that when the dust cleared, it wasn't that much of a success. Could you talk a little bit about her experience?
Well, you know, Michelle Rhee is apparently a very telegenic and exciting media figure, but it's hard to see that she has done anything in Washington, D.C. that should be emulated anywhere else. Her big thing was to say that she had some really horrible teachers, and she fired hundreds of teachers. She fired a lot of principals. And yet today, Washington, D.C., as in the past, continues to have the largest achievement gap of any city tested by the federal government. The achievement gap between black and white students and between Hispanic and white students is double the size of other cities. I mean, we're talking about a 60-point gap in D.C. on the federal test as compared to a 30-point gap in other cities. So Washington, D.C. has seen lots of turmoil. Lots of teachers come and go. They have a very, very young teacher corps now because so many experienced teachers were either fired or left. But there's not a lot to show for it. Michelle Rhee also is, you know, she was on the cover of Time magazine. She's on the cover of Newsweek magazine. She's been featured in TV documentaries. And she's now advising some of the most right-wing governors in the country, Chris Christie in New Jersey, Rick Scott in Florida, Scott Walker in Wisconsin. And she's been, I know, recently touring through the South, encouraging states to pass charter legislation. And in Indiana, she was side-by-side with Governor Mitch Daniels advocating vouchers. So I don't entirely understand what she hopes to accomplish, because it's very clear from everything I've seen that these are not solutions to any of the problems we have.
Let's go back to our final caller now. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Diane Ravitch.
Hello. Yeah, I'd like to comment on the state of education. I believe over 80% of students do not use advanced mathematics or their foreign language. And if the school systems would internalize and purge some of these classes, then they'd have more affordability for more relevant courses. Secondly, there was a recent article in News Gazette on what students read. They had like 15 or 20 books listed. Most of them were fiction, and I believe a much more valuable book is biography, because it is real life. It deals with real situations, real history. And thirdly, what I'd like to see is TV in the classroom so that the public could tune it in and see what the teachers are teaching. I certainly wish I had that when I had 3 years of Latin, and all we did was learn how to translate it. We didn't learn about the culture at all. So I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Diane Ravitch?
Well, thank you. I would really hate to see schools get rid of advanced math, because I think that in terms of those students who are willing and able to do advanced math, we need them. And there's a lot of talk in the country about how we have a shortage of people prepared for the college courses and for the careers that require science and math and technology. So I wouldn't want to discourage that. I also think this is true with foreign languages. If anything, we should have more kids learning foreign languages, because I strongly believe everyone should have certainly a command of the English language, but then one other language I think will serve them well in life, and just the study of another language. Maybe it wasn't the case in learning Latin, but the study of another language helps you understand the world through another culture. As far as having TV in the classroom, when I think of all the millions of classrooms in America, I don't know how you would decide which one should be on TV, but I do think that the public should try to go and visit schools, and I think that principals and teachers should reach out and invite the community to come into the schools and sit in classrooms, because I don't think most people have any idea how school has changed since they were in school themselves. It is very different. The challenge is much greater. We have children with disabilities who are mainstreamed. We have children who don't speak English, who need extra help. We have discipline problems. We have some incredibly gifted teachers who are doing their best under difficult circumstances. And I think that the public really needs to come in and be part of that and realize that their public schools are part of their community.
Dan Ravitch, we've already talked, I just talked about the glowing coverage, and you confirmed it too, of Michelle Rhee and her campaign. And you've also talked about how there's so much money from foundations and in the billions of dollars now that is promoting some variant of the sort of business market solution. And all of these variants sort of are very critical of teachers' unions and teachers as being the variable that's really most to blame and needs to change for this whole process. How would you characterize, if you could, the media coverage of education policy issues that for the average citizen just who relies upon news media to get a handle on this, do you think the media has done a very effective job of drawing them in to the debates and giving them the issues and evidence they need to participate?
Actually, I would say the media coverage of public education has been absolutely god-awful. It has just been dreadful. The very fact that so many of these very really destructive policies have rebranded themselves as their reforms. And so you have governors who are looking to privatize education, and they present it as a reform policy. Now, most of what's called reform today, 20 years ago, would have been called a very conservative agenda. It would have been associated with Ronald Reagan. It's now associated, a lot of this model legislation is coming from a far-right group of state legislators called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. And state after state is where the conservatives have taken control of the legislature is proposing this model legislation from this organization, and yet it gets called reform. So you have Governor Scott Walker has reform legislation to break the unions, and reform legislation from Governor Jindal advocating vouchers and charters, and reform legislation from Governor Christie to take away pensions and tenure and introduce charters and, if possible, vouchers. All of this is called reform, but it used to be called the right-wing agenda. So the media has been incredibly critical in allowing people who are advancing ideas that have no basis in research or evidence to call themselves reformers, when I would say they could just as well say that people who totally disagree with them are the real reformers.
On that note, we've only got a minute or so left. Could you just give some sense of what you think a healthy school system would look like, or public education system would look like going forward for the United States? What would be the key elements of it?
Well, I think the key elements would be, first of all, that as a society, we would take more responsibility for the well-being of our children and make sure that children come to school healthy and ready to learn. I also believe that every school would have a well-balanced curriculum where children have the arts. Of course, they have the basic skills, but where they have teachers who are well-prepared, who have had at least a year of professional preparation before they became teachers, and where teachers are respected. I think if we had those ingredients in place where school and society could work together around the needs of children and with a vision of good education, we would be much happier with our schools and with ourselves.
Diane Ravitch, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. I want to thank you for taking time out of your Sunday to come talk to us about your work and your book, The Life and Death of the Great American School System.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
It has indeed been a pleasure for me, too. And I want to also thank, of course, Christina Williams, my producer, Kyle Kroha, my engineer, both of them for helping me today. 1 week from today, we're going to have a recorded show with John Nichols, and then we'll be back in 2 weeks with a live show. Everyone have a great week, and knock 'em dead. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather today, showers and thunderstorms throughout the day, near record highs in the mid-80s. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows in the upper 50s. Monday, mostly sunny, near record highs in the lower 80s, and southeast winds gusting to around 25 miles an hour. Monday night, partly cloudy. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM.